Callan, as you may or may not know. And what I would start by doing is reading you the four pages of my speech, which I jettisoned because of time constraints, which was actually the meat of my speech. It's sort of a quick overview of my sense of having interviewed more long-term survivors. I personally know more long-term survivors than anybody else, as far as I can tell. I called George Solomon, who's doing a long-term survivor study, and my numbers are bigger than his numbers, so size matters, right? Proof once again. I hate to read, but my brain is tired, so bear with me. As far as I can tell, I know more long-term AIDS survivors than anyone in the world. A notice I placed in the People with AIDS Coalition newsline last fall seeking long-term survivors has produced dozens of replies. Despite a persistent feeling that to talk about surviving is to jinx it, the prospect of meeting someone else who beat the odds apparently overcame all reluctance. If I had to describe in one word the common characteristic of the people with AIDS survivors that I interviewed, it would be grit. These people are all fighters, opinionated, incredibly knowledgeable about AIDS, stubborn, and passionately committed to living. These men and women have worked hard to stay alive. And they were all involved in the politics of AIDS, interestingly enough. Some by becoming publicly identified, others by counseling and operating hotlines. Politics may well be the antidote to that self-obsession which often comes with AIDS. To realize that there's someone worse off than you whom you can help is an incredible relief and may even be healing. In the course of over two dozen interviews, I discovered patterns, but no one pattern. And I really want to stop my remarks and emphasize that. No one is keeping any secrets. There isn't a way to be a long-term survivor. There is no treatment, holistic or Western, that all of the long-term survivors that I met were on. So please don't overinterpret anything I say. I'm really going to give you a sketch. And I would never want it to be attributed to me that I'm keeping the secret of longevity for people with AIDS, because I already get enough calls from people who've just been diagnosed wanting to know what they should do. So, I discovered patterns, but no one pattern. Some had returned to the bosom of their families, while others were as obstinately alienated as ever. Some had noble, caring lovers, while others were single. But all of them, interestingly enough, considered themselves to be eligible. They were in the market, and I'm the Yenta of the AIDS movement, so in some instances, I was able to help fix them up. Some were working full-time and proud of it. Others were working full-time at disability. Some had sworn off drinking, smoking, and recreational drugging, but not all. One of the longest-surviving PWAs gleefully recounted doing and dealing cocaine from his hospital bed while undergoing experimental treatments from an IV unit attached to his arm with interferon. Some survivors insisted that they owe their lives to experimental therapies, while others attributed their survival to the fact that they had refused to be guinea pigs. Despite intense pressure among physicians to take AZT, the only federally approved treatment for AIDS, only one of the long-term gay survivors was on AZT. When I asked why they hadn't hopped on the AZT bandwagon, most echoed PWA Bruce Zacher's quip that if it ain't broke, don't fix it. On the other hand, all the blacks and Hispanics I interviewed are on AZT. State and federal subsidies that provide AZT for free encourage its use among the poor. If, as some of us suspect, AZT proves to have done more harm than good, we will have another example of where good intentions backfired, costing the lives of minorities. One long-term survivor of KS, whom I'll call Thomas, it's not his real name, has completely turned his back on Western medicine in favor of macrobiotics. At 48, he literally glows with health, proof that Western medicine hasn't cornered the market on AIDS treatments. And in fact, everyone I talked to had at least dabbled with holistic therapies. More surprising to me than an interest in past life regression in Shirley MacLaine was a rekindling of religious sentiment. A majority of long-term survivors spoke movingly about a return to the faith of their childhood. Others spoke more generally about a spiritual rebirth. I hadn't expected to discover so much religious faith because it certainly hasn't played any role in my own survival. I have filed safely away a signed, notarized document indicating that any request I might make for religious assistance is to be taken as prima facie evidence of dementia sufficient to invoke my power of attorney. My own explanation for the recrudescence of religious sentiment among long-term survivors would be this. The psychoneuroimmunologists may be right. There may well be a biological will to live, and marshaling this will requires hope. And when rational systems offer no hope, we turn to those systems which do. In our culture, that means religious systems that speak of life after death, of meaning to suffering, of a caring, paternal God who will take care of you. But if I ask myself the hard question, what was truly different about these long-term survivors, I'm forced to admit that I can't really say. I have known many who had rekindled spirituality yet succumbed to AIDS. Others passionately committed to the political fight against AIDS have also fallen in battle. In the end, even after meeting more long-term survivors than anyone else in the world, I have concluded that there simply isn't a definitive answer. No one can say for sure why some of us have survived and some of us haven't. Luck is the word we use to describe forces which we do not yet understand. Miracles is just the ecclesiastical version of luck. Take two gay men with identical, devastatingly poor blood tests. One develops PCP, the other doesn't, and no one can yet explain why. As CDC researcher Ann Hardy found, two individuals can have the same disease, pneumocystis pneumonia. One has HIV, the other doesn't, and what this means, no one can say. The best I can surmise is that hope, a passionate commitment to fighting for one's life, is necessary but not sufficient ingredient for survival. It won't guarantee that you beat AIDS, but you've got to have it to even be in the running. All the survivors join me in bitterly denouncing the media's glib denials of our very existence. Gaetano Alimo complained, quote, "It's devastating. It's so fatalistic. I've become, no pun intended, immune to these kind of things. Only because I feel when you hear it so much, after a while you just file it away. You say, oh, there's that train of thought again." Some long-term survivors no longer even read newspapers. Others turn off the TV when they hear AIDS mentioned. Helmut, who has survived KS since 1982, hates to hear the lie that there are no survivors. Quote, "I want to tap the TV set and raise my hand. I'm sure that there are others out there who could use a little slap on the back saying, it's okay, there are others of us." So that's what I cut from my speech, and now I'll talk a little more specifically about the individual people, some of whose names I can mention and some of whose names I can't. The first person I interviewed was the Reverend Stephen Peters in Los Angeles. Some of you may know him. Amazing person. He's a minister in the MCC, very attractive, a weightlifter. He is the sole survivor of the Suhrman trial in Los Angeles. And he nearly died from Suhrman. He took Suhrman longer than any human on earth, and it nearly killed him. But he had KS and stage 4 lymphoma, in which he is now in complete remission. He had a near-death experience as a result of toxicity from Suhrman, and he spoke very beautifully about how that near-death experience changed his life. It's a lot of what Bernie Siegel talks about. He experienced his own death. He felt his spirit sail above him and watch himself on the operating room table as they were trying to do CPR and put in all this stuff, and they were screaming at him. They couldn't find a vein, and they said, pump your hand, and he couldn't. And he remembered watching and sort of feeling very warm towards his doctor and saying, whatever happens is okay, and letting go, and he survived. And since that time, he was religious to begin with, but he's not afraid of death, and he definitely considers that part of his healing process. He also says that he thinks celebrating his gayness is part of healing. He believes in fairies, as he said. And I will say that every gay person, I should explain who I interviewed and how many. I interviewed 20 white gay men, no, 19 white gay men, one Hispanic gay man, one bisexual gay man who had also used IV drugs, and three IV drug-using black and Hispanic women. And I had to use different yardsticks for long-term survival because the Rothenberg study that I mentioned earlier found that women with AIDS only survive an average of 6 months. So basically, I doubled the median, and all of the women had been alive for a year or more, and all of the men had been alive for at least 3 years beyond their diagnosis, and some significantly longer than 3 years. So that's Stephen Peter's story. So he was an example of someone who had been a guinea pig, who had definitely attributed part of his long-term survival to Thurman, but recognized that it had killed everyone else, and also felt that there was a component for him of spirituality and letting go of the fear of death. And he also, like everybody else, dabbles in holistics, a little acupuncture here, a little visualization, a little past life regression, crystals, Louise Hay. The next person I interviewed was Christopher Shihar, who broke all the rules. He's the... I shouldn't say this. Never mind. I won't say this. There are some things I can't say. He broke all the rules. He didn't set out to be a long-term survivor. He lived one day at a time and dealt with whatever presented itself and woke up 4 years later and realized that he was a long-term survivor. And has since, it's sort of strange, has since, as a result of being a long-term survivor, become very involved in Louise Hay and the holistic spiritual movement and believes in spontaneous writing and is a real sweetheart and is single. So if any of you live in L.A., he's one of the people I'm trying to fix up. He's eligible. Well, what I'd rather do is just sort of go through them quickly because I interviewed people in Kansas, Houston, a lot in New York City, a lot in San Francisco, and a lot in Los Angeles. Maybe there won't be time to go through all of them. Maybe I should go for trends or tell you the unusual stories that jumped out at me. I can't tell you how moved I was as one of the most irreligious persons you're likely to meet at the role that spirituality, defined variously, played, that people attributed a role to spirituality. I think it's a lot of what Bernie Siegel talks about. Everybody had a moment, except for Christopher Shihar, where they decided that they wanted to live. And many of them spoke very movingly about that moment. And everybody talked about what I call the roller coaster of AIDS. Some days are good, some days are bad, and you have to learn how to manage the bad days, to find something good in a bad day, to set reasonable goals for yourself. If you're really feeling awful, maybe taking a bath is your day's accomplishment, and you should stroke yourself for that. And maybe tomorrow you can take a shower and walk around. I was struck by how few of the gay men were on AZT, and I want to be very careful here. I am not on AZT, and I think AZT is going to be the second scandal of the AIDS epidemic. I think the clinical trials were some of the sloppiest in history. And I think the toxicity, I've seen the toxicity wreak havoc, although I know there are people in this room on AZT. I try to be very careful because your choice of what treatments to take, holistic and otherwise, are life and death decisions for you. And I don't want to bully anybody into taking or not taking a substance. I can only say that I'm not on AZT and you could not pay me to be on AZT. And I was quite startled to find that the other long-term survivors that I interviewed, the gay long-term survivors, were also not on AZT. in many instances despite tremendous pressure from their doctors to go on it. The other thing that really jumped out at me was political involvement. And I can't tell whether this is sort of experiment or bias. The fact that I ran a notice for long-term survivors in the People with AIDS Newsline means that I got mostly people who would read the Newsline, know about the Newsline, probably be more political. But absolutely every long-term survivor either is currently or had spent a significant amount of time being involved in the AIDS movement or the lesbian and gay movement or in some instances the other civil rights struggles, the anti-nuke movement. And their commitment was passionate, and they really believed that by helping others they were helping themselves. I found no patterns in terms of diet. A lot of people had tried various diets and found they couldn't stick with them. I found no one substance, not AL-721, not ribavirin. Individual long-term survivors had tried all of them, some in various combinations. And my speculation about that is that I'm not convinced, and I'm very involved in the AIDS treatment underground. I founded with other people, the People with AIDS Health Group, which first introduced lipids into the AIDS community. And I can tell you personally that I don't feel anything when I take my lipids. But I am regaled by stories of other people who say it's dramatically, their appetite's back, their fevers are down, it's changed their lives. I know a number of people who claim to have come back from near death on lipids. My suspicion is twofold. One, as you know, I don't believe HIV is the cause of AIDS. And it follows from that belief that I don't think that what we're calling AIDS is actually one disease, and therefore I don't think we're ever going to find one substance that is going to work in everybody the same way. And that's why I think different people report exciting results from lipids and other people feel nothing, and some people say I feel terrific on antabuse and my T cells have doubled, and other people say I feel nothing. And so I would, the long-term survivors supported my view that keep an open mind, be very aware of toxicity issues. You have a spectrum of substances to choose from, some of which are not toxic or have low toxicity, but we don't know whether they have any efficacy. We don't know whether they work. Then we have other substances like AZT, which may or may not work, but which are extremely toxic. And a lot of the long-term survivors concentrated at this end, although some had also been at this end, but moved from this end to that end. After, basically, it was very strange to me. People who, like Stephen Peters, who had gambled on Sermon or in an experimental drug trial and won, felt that it contributed to their survival, nevertheless weren't willing to gamble again on a second experimental treatment. It was almost like, when you gamble, getting out while you've got the money rather than taking the chance of betting it all again. What else can I say about the long-term survivors? Everybody talked about major, major lifestyle changes in sex, recreational drug use. Although different people, some people were still smoking a lot of pot, but they'd given up alcohol and they'd given up ecstasy and all the recreational drugs, and some people were on cocaine. I should quickly say that when I started, I was only finding people, it was concerning me, I was only finding people who had survived KS, and I thought, oh no, am I going to have to report that there are no long-term survivors of pneumocystis? Then literally in one day, I bumped into two of them on the street who said, oh, I've been meaning to call you. Yeah, I had pneumocystis in 1982. And so there, clearly, your chances of being a long-term survivor if your only opportunistic infection is KS are great, really great. If you have other opportunistic complications, it's not that you can't be a long-term survivor, but the facts are that there are fewer long-term survivors that I was able to find of pneumocystis and some of the other opportunistic complications than there were of KS. However, I happen to believe, as I think I said yesterday, that aerosol pentamidine for the prevention of the number one killer of AIDS. Dear Lifemed over here, that whose booth you see and who's underwriting this conference, will in a single stroke, in my opinion, double or triple long-term survival. The number one killer of people with AIDS is pneumocystis, and we can now prevent it. There is no excuse, none, if your doctor is competent, for you to get your first bout of pneumocystis, much less a second. So I just got through saying that I don't like to preach about treatments, but this is the only one that I really preach about. Pneumocystis prevention works. Either 2 Bactrim DS a day, if you can tolerate it, 4 Dapsone a day. There are some problems with Fanzidar. Other people were experimenting with Fanzidar. But what everybody is very excited about is breathing aerosol pentamidine. It's coming in through the front door rather than going through the back door. And any of you people with AIDS who have had IV administration of pentamidine, it's nothing like that at all. There are no side effects that we've discovered so far to inhaling an aerosolized form of pentamidine. Well, that little filter that they have things over there, there have been different machines, and we are refining our knowledge about what dose and what machine to use, and the new machines and the new inhalators have sort of like a cigarette filter tip, which keeps the taste from being dreadful. Because I agree with you. Originally, it was like inhaling metal shavings. You felt for 2 days afterwards that everything tasted of metal. Right. I'm one of the people that has bronchospasms. And if we have found that people who smoke cigarettes have some trouble inhaling aerosol pentamidine, the logic being that you're the lining is irritated from smoking, and so pentamidine is an irritant. It kills the parasite. But the advantage of aerosol is what I say, it comes through the front door rather than the back door. The way IV pentamidine works is that you build up sufficient blood levels that it finally kills them in your lungs, but it also sometimes takes you with it in terms of liver toxicity and spleen toxicity. Where you need pentamidine is in the lungs, and we now know that you can go through the front door and inhale it, and it sits in the lungs and keeps you from getting pneumocystis. Yes. The knowledge of when it is rational to prophylax, because pentamidine is very expensive, is being refined. In New York, it is thought that if you have under 200 T cells and other laboratory evidence of immune deficiency, your doctor should have you on some form of prophylaxis. Now, I have heard, because there are people here from all over the country, it's largely a New York and San Francisco phenomenon, because this is where the trials are being done, but and Seattle. If any of you need more information about pentamidine, see me, and I will give you the number of people who can tell you what dose is currently being used, what particle size needs to be attained, and if your doctors refuse to do it, get another doctor. That's how strongly I feel about it. Before I take questions, let me just sort of see if there's anything else I should say, and then I would like, right, questions should be through the microphone. Dr. Levy, if you'd like to come up, you're welcome. If you would rather sit there, Dr. Levy is going to present this afternoon, but she has been studying some long-term surviving KS patients on macrobiotics. What I had envisioned is I recognize many people with AIDS and ARC in this room, and I would like to invite you to participate with full credibility. Maybe you know a long-term survivor, or you have your own suspicions about what is contributing to your survival to date, and I think we should share that with each other. I don't want to set myself up as an expert. It's quite an accident that I happen to know more long-term survivors than anybody. I think it's just because I asked. I went in search. And I will tell you that the state of the science, as far as I can tell, there is George Solomon's study, which is very exciting. The CDC is doing a follow-up study on long-term survivors and at the current time has made the unbelievable decision to only ask 7 questions. They're afraid that if they ask questions about diet and spirituality, that the questionnaire will be too long and the health department personnel who are being asked to administer it won't do it. So we are, as far as I can tell at this point, going to be losing some tremendously valuable data because the CDC is finally going back through their records and contacting long-term survivors and is doing some blood work and stuff on them, as I mentioned in my speech. But the psychosocial variables, which admittedly are difficult to study, they're not even going to make an attempt. At least I begged her, I implored her to change the mind of the CDC, and she said that it hadn't been completely ruled out, but for logistic reasons, she thought that probably they would end up only asking 7 or 8 questions. As I mentioned in my speech, I was lucky enough to know the longest survivor of AIDS. His name was Larry, and I considered it absolutely crucial to the fact that I'm still here. Knowing early on that someone had survived the supposedly incurable disease for 3 years, and this guy was cute. Whew. And running a business, working 40 hours a week, great sense of humor, didn't believe any of the hogwash that was being told to him. I mean, he was diagnosed before the acronym AIDS existed. And he lived 9 years. And he abused drugs, cocaine, again, that cocaine keeps popping up. He didn't make, so far as I know, and I only knew him through the support group, and then I would occasionally bump into him on the street. So far as I know, he did not get involved in any spiritual movement or any diet or anything, but he sure was having a hell of a good time living and was passionately committed to living, and he unfortunately died about 2 months ago. I have no idea of what or under what circumstances. I haven't been able to contact the family. No one is talking. And the last thing I'll say is because it was so important to me to know long-term survivors, that's part of the reason that I stand up and say that I'm a long-term survivor. And I am attempting to publish the full transcripts of these interviews because they are amazing. And what I'm doing is I've transcribed most of the tapes. I'm sending them back to the people to give them the opportunity to edit, correct, take out references to evil lovers of the past, or do whatever they want to do to make themselves comfortable. And then I'm going to look for a publisher. In the meantime, I have an article that is threatening to come out in the New York Village Voice. It's been supposed to be the front cover story since December. It was supposed to be out this Wednesday. Now they say it's next Wednesday, so I'm not holding my breath. But if any of you are interested and have access to the Village Voice, it may someday be on the front cover of the Voice. So at this point, I'd like to invite questions from the audience and comments. If you have any strong feelings about, if you've known other people who've survived for a long time and you have anything to say about why you think that was so, or please step forward. Why don't you come to the microphones because they want to record all this. Identify yourselves if you would like.
Yes, my name is Tara Poss. I just wanted to point out that there's a very informative article about inhalant pentamidine in the new issue of Mile High on Life, which is a newsletter that a number of us in this room put together. It's a newsletter put together by PWAs and for PWAs in the Denver metro area. So if anyone's interested in more information about who's doing inhalant pentamidine in Colorado and a little bit about the background of pentamidine, It's in that issue over there. I think I have survived and thrived with AIDS mainly because I decided to get involved rather than being depressed. And I'm involved with the newsletter. I'm involved with the Colorado AIDS Project, volunteer organizations, and I think that that's really what has helped me.
Terrific. Good luck.
Yeah, I'd like to continue on that. My name is Rick Graff. I'm real interested in everyone being involved in politics, because there's times when it seems like you're just hitting your head against the wall, and it's really, really stressful. I would like to hear from you and other PWAs of how you manage that frustration and keep it from actually affecting your health.
I'm glad you asked that question, because I left that out. All of the PWAs except me, long-term survivors, talked about the problem of burnout, and that part of being good to themselves was taking regular breaks from being publicly identified people with AIDS, taking vacations, doing workshops that were nurturing to them. And I haven't done that, and I had a very, very bad health month last month. And my lover confiscated my address book, canceled a week's worth of appointments, and rented a batch of videos. So I can't stress for you the importance of, it's what I think I said to you yesterday about that. One of the people with AIDS movement, join the PWA movement first. Those are like-minded people who aren't going to really stress you out, share information with others. And what, in New York, one of the things that I didn't mention that I'm the most proud of, actually there are two things I want to talk about, is the Community Research Initiative. The People with AIDS Coalition is sponsoring clinical research into promising AIDS treatments. And that comes from what you're talking about. We decided to stop banging our heads up against the wall of federal indifference and saying, why aren't there trials? What's taking so long? We have the expertise within our own community. We've organized community physicians who have large patient populations. We attracted a stellar group of scientific people who share the frustration. We put together an institutional review board, and we have six trials up and ongoing. Ampligen, hyperimmunized cow's milk in the treatment of cryptosporidium, erythropoietin in the treatment of anemia, two trials of lipids, one oral administration and intravenous administration, and a 200-person aerosol pentamidine trial in AIDS. And we are currently negotiating with LifeMed for a trial of aerosol pentamidine in the prevention of pneumocystis in ARC. So find situations where your energy can be constructive. Let the healthy people do the demonstration and act up, unless that's nurturing to you, or pull in and pull out of different movements. The other thing I'd like to say before we get more questions is I hope that everyone has seen, in fact, I hope I have one in my pocket. It's Surviving and Thriving with AIDS. It's a publication of the People with AIDS Coalition, and you can see me after this for how to get it if you don't already have it. It's in the words of people with AIDS, how to cope with AIDS, and it's broken down into varying sessions. And I'm the editor, and I'm currently working on an update, and I would welcome articles from people with AIDS and ARC in other localities. That is one of the holes that I've plugged, as well as articles from women and people of color and their experience of dealing with AIDS, and hemophiliacs and their experience of dealing with AIDS. So see me about that. And last, before I take my questions, the thing of which I am personally the most proud in my AIDS work is that I run wildly successful singles teas where every month 200 people with AIDS and ARC get together to meet and mate, and I'm utterly shameless, and I ask all these compatibility questions, and people are marrying left and right. And that flows from my own personal experience that having a lover has been absolutely crucial to my own survival. And different people have a different definition of lovers, but it's nice to be held at night. It's very nurturing. And if you have AIDS or ARC, don't assume that you're damaged merchandise or factory seconds. There are those people who will. Don't use it as an excuse not to take the risk. There is some chauvinism, I'm embarrassed to report. Some people with AIDS will only date people with AIDS. Some people with ARC will only date people with ARC. But then there are also all possible combinations. So, more questions, I guess.
I missed the beginning of your presentation, and I was curious about the long-term survivors and if any of them had used alternative medicines such as acupuncture, naturopathic medicine, Tibetan, Ayurvedic. If any of that information is available.
Again, without claiming that my sample is at all scientifically representative, everyone had dabbled with everything that you, not everyone had done everything, but everything you listed had been tried by some of the long-term survivors. And except for passionate commitment to things like visualization and other sort of spiritual things, there was no one pattern. Some people were on acupuncture, some people weren't. And there was a lot of dabbling. People would try a little of this, a little of that, drop it, move on to this, the latest fad. But I took that, instead of saying, oh, these people aren't making a commitment, I took that as they're keeping an open mind and they're exploring things that might work for them. And some things seem to make them feel better than others, and then they stuck with those. Bob?
It's sort of a political question, only because I also believe in pentamidine, but then the question is who uses it. Now, we have loads of people in Miami who carry their own personal machines. Only a few of the hospitals even remotely interested. I mean, the lack of coordination within the profession is extraordinary, and I know that places...
Murderous is the word I
there
would
you,
use.
There you go. And places like Boston and Dallas don't even have it. I mean, it seems that here's one area where we need to have an impact on making sure that the entire system, regardless of income and flexibility, what have you, has to deal with this issue in terms of saving lives. And we put a lot of pressure on everybody we can, which is one reason why we don't always get their money, because they don't like that kind of pressure. But we're interested in saving lives. And I wonder if we could address this a little bit more, at least in terms of your experience in New York.
As I've traveled around the country, I have recommended organizing sort of collectives. Buy one machine, and then the things you actually inhale through are disposable. And some of this that I'm going to suggest is not entirely legal, but one prescription of pentamidine is 300 milligrams, and what's currently being recommended in New York is 100 milligrams to be inhaled. So if you've got somebody who's got insurance or Medicaid, and a doctor will write a prescription for one bottle of pentamidine, that will actually supply three people. And you're not technically supposed to store it for more than 24 hours, so you can sort of justify, if I only need 100 and it only comes packaged in 300, then I'd have to be pouring out 200 and wasting it, so I may as well not do that. I may as well give it away to someone who can't afford it. We can talk more about some other interesting approaches.
Right.
To... It's going to take, as it took in New York and San Francisco, the patients and those few doctors who have made it their priority to keep their patients alive as opposed to win the Nobel Prize. Those people are going to have to stand up and demand it. They're going to have to say any doctor who is not prophylaxing their patients is committing malpractice. That's a word that seems to wake them up.
Well, one step further on that, I feel like the system is ready to bend, and I just attended a Florida Medical Association ad hoc committee on AIDS, and the word that came out of that was phenomenal malpractice. I mean, if there was three or a dozen doctors out of 16,000 in the state who knew what they were talking about, it'd be a miracle. I think the question of going on the offense to push the system right now so that we're not just dealing on this underground level. I mean, we've got to tackle masses of people, and I see that it's a lot easier to deal with this than $1,000 a day in the hospital. Even
exactly.
In terms of the political system, they're getting freaked out. So I'm wondering if we could create some sort of strategy of mobilizing this energy.
I assume you'll put that on the list of action questions that...
I will now, thank you.
Terrific. I'm serious. I consider in the last 2 years that anyone who's died of pneumocystis pneumonia was murdered. That they didn't need to die, that if they had received proper, compassionate, educated medical care, they would not have died of pneumocystis. They might have died of some other complication, some other kind of pneumonia that pentamidine doesn't prevent. But this was my point. This is part of my passion about how much I loathe the religion of HIV. Rather than setting out to... doctors at the beginning of AIDS should have said, what is our number one problem with AIDS? Immediately, pneumocystis, 68% of deaths. They should have said, is there anything we can do about pneumocystis? And in the literature, it was obvious, because kidney transplant patients are put on prophylaxis, TB patients are put on prophylaxis. But no, we want the Nobel Prize. We want to make AIDS go away. Meanwhile, people are dropping like flies from diseases which are preventable and treatable. And so if you come out of this with one thing, what I would say to you, Bob, is that the people with AIDS directly themselves, their first priority has got to be to save their own life. And then if they have any energy left, they can get involved in the larger political fray for the greater good of the greater number of people. But if you're a person with AIDS or ARC and you have under 200 T cells, the current wisdom in New York is that you should be on some form of pneumocystis prevention. I don't remember which side we're supposed to, I guess, this side.
I'm Don Holloway.
Hi, Don.
Michael, I wanted to say thank you publicly to you for being editor of Surviving and Thriving with AIDS.
Thank you.
And then a question. Bernie Siegel has mentioned the exceptional patient, the one that takes control. You have mentioned that. In your interviews, did you find any pattern of the doctor-patient relationship?
Yes, I'm sorry I left that out. Every single long-term survivor had ordered a doctor or a nurse out of their room or had refused a procedure until it would be explained to them. We long-term survivors are the frisky patients that Bernie Siegel mentioned. We have bad reputations because we got a million questions, and many of us will not let a procedure be done on us. For example, my first bronchoscopy led to my first and last bronchoscopy I had serious complications from, and I'm never being bronchoscoped again, ever. And, you know, the doctors go, oh, come on, let us go back in there every time I'm short of breath. No. Treat me as if I have pneumocystis or treat me with some broad-spectrum antibiotic, and if I start to get better, what does it matter what it is? I sort of bent my rules, and I was endoscoped 3 times in 4 months because they think I have lymphoma of the esophagus. And sure enough, one of my biopsy spots burst, and I had a bleeding ulcer, and I had to be hospitalized for a complication of the procedure. So take charge. It's your life, your body. Everybody spoke of a partnership with their healthcare providers.
May I follow up with that? Did you have the sense that any of the patients had a real impact upon their doctor, other than being the exceptional patient and being contrary?
What I found, it's like water finds its own level or something, that exceptional patients sought out exceptional doctors, that there were very few instances where somebody who was sort of constipated and conservative had been changed by something that some success on the patient's part or some lecture from the patients, although theoretically I'm sure something like that could happen.
My name is Mark Bernard, and I was diagnosed 2.5 years ago. And though I don't meet your criteria, I consider myself a long-term survivor.
Good for you.
Something that really impacted me early on was being fortunate enough to be on a lecture on the epidemiology of AIDS shortly after my diagnosis. And one of the questions asked the doctor who was giving the lecture was, why is it that some people seem to just get sick and die after their diagnosis, and why some people seem to be, as you call them, long-term survivors? And he thought about it for a little bit and said, well, you know, it doesn't seem to be so much the dance you do, but the balance you keep doing the steps. And I think it's real important that this is a very multifaceted disease that, you know, I don't think it's going to be any one step or quick cure or magic bullet that's going to take care of it, but rather a complex, personally subjective combination of steps that make up our own individual dances. And I'm still dancing.
Good for you. We couldn't agree more.
My name is Felicia Bryant. I'm from the San Francisco Bay Area, and I attended a conference with the HABC group at the MCC Church, and a lot of people shared some of the therapies that they're using, and I wanted to share a story that really had courage in it to me. A gentleman had toxo and was so bad that he could not even get out of his bed to get to the restroom, and had gone beyond even being able to crawl through his house, and was determined to get past that, and had doctors trying to put him on some real intense medicines that are proven to show toxicity. And I think it's real important at this conference that people share all their different therapies, because not the same thing will work for all the same people. And as long as you know as many things as possible from as many people with as many different symptoms, then you're able to choose what may or may not work for yourself. And he began taking intense amounts of garlic and up to 16 cloves a day, intense amounts of vitamin C every 2 hours. And along with changing his entire eating habits, and his x-rays for his brain scans have improved. And he gave a lecture about 2 months after he had actually collapsed at the conference.
Terrific. Good for him.
My name is Roland, and I was diagnosed with AIDS in June. And I was at 112 pounds, and I could hardly walk. I had lost all of my hair. I was having a lot of problems. But I think what turned me around is I was doing some visualization techniques on my own. And then I stumbled upon the Bernie Siegel book, which helped me improve my techniques. That's the reason why I have come to this conference. because after reading that book, it made me take control of my own healing. So I had to confront some doctors at Denver General.
Good for you.
And step on some toes and make some people angry. But I'm just very proud to say that they all attended the conference.
Great.
That's right. And they went and they bought the book and made it a staff requirement.
Good.
That's right. Also, I decided to start living and not accept death. I had locked myself in the basement for about 4 months, not answering the phone, avoiding everyone. And
I'm standing here thinking I should tell you all, why don't you just boo me now for what I'm about to say?
Very good.
My name is Carol Williams, and I'm an AIDS research project nurse from New York. I only see people on AZT, on and off protocol, and I've seen wonderful things happen in about the last 2 years. The first 6 or 8 months were very devastating because we were seeing our patients in a medical clinic, and you could pick out our patients. They were very cachectic, and the agony of watching people literally slip away when you tried everything. And we tried everything that everyone here is saying. Why don't physicians or nurses or the medical profession have some sort of a sixth sense that you can make us better? Well, that was before AZT. And we now have our own clinic, but it's truly filled with the beautiful people. They're very good looking, they're very energetic. And we've noticed something different happening. AIDS, of course, you put it on a disability form and you get disability. And we had great difficulty convincing people after a while that you could go off disability and maybe get on with your life and go back to school and perhaps go back to your work. Maybe move out of your parents' home and get on with where you wanted to be in another area of the country. And it was like, we have no future. We have AIDS. We're going to die. And now we see people going off disability. We see them buying new businesses. We see them buying new houses and redoing them. And we see people that are really celebrating life. And I guess I would like to make a very big push for about 2 or 3 things. Number one, it is a team effort. And the overwhelming burden of the medical profession to cure people is impossible. It's unrealistic. I love cranky patients. I love them when they say, I want to try this or I'm interested in this. And quite frankly, the underground network of gay people, they know more about all these other things. And that's one of the things that I would like to see, how you can condense this. But I think the burden of finding out your path belongs to the patient. I would also say, however, that when you start dictating to your physician what things he can do for you, you need to accept the responsibility that he's not being able to treat you as he totally sees fit, as far as his knowledge goes. The other thing about AZT is I think it's only part of the picture, and I give about 95% of my patients the pitch of Bernie Siegel's book, and I would like to share a little story with you that just happened this week. I have a young college graduate who is very close to AIDS and was thinking about suicide and finally got her to read Bernie Siegel's book, and she came back to me last week and said, I want to live and I'm no longer thinking about suicide. So I guess if it's one pitch from the medical profession is that there's many things that makes up a long-term survivor. Thank you.
Why would we have booed you? I thought that was wonderful. Before I take your question, I want to be very clear about AZT. I hope I was clear that it's my opinion that I wouldn't take AZT. As I said about other substances, I know some people who seem to be doing very well on AZT. They're a very small minority within my knowledge in New York, and I know a lot of people who have become transfusion dependent, who turn the color of spam, and who are having real problems, and people who just can't tolerate it at all. And my point about AZT is that I don't know anybody, although I discovered someone here at the conference, who's on full dose. Everybody that I know in New York is on half dose, or a week on, a week off, or they're combining with acyclovir, which is as magic as lipids. We think we know a little bit about what AZT does taken at full dose every 4 hours, and I would argue that we don't really know that because the trials were really terrible. But we certainly don't know about the effects of AZT, except anecdotally in doses that are not full doses. And I'm not discouraging you from taking less than a full dose. In fact, it's a compromise position between mine and maybe yours. Take a half dose if you want, but I'm trying to suggest that the clinical medical establishment doesn't respect anecdotal reports, and I do. If somebody's taking a substance, whether it's AZT or lipids, and they say, I feel better, that's what's important to me, not some placebo double-blind trial. Those have to happen, and they'll happen at their snail's pace, and they should live and be well, these clinical researchers. But when your back is up against the wall, the information that you can gather from the experience of another person is to me much, much more important. Can I let her respond to that?
And I'll make it brief. One thing is the off-protocol packaging of AZT is only for those people who have AIDS or high ARC with lower than T4 cells. So the people who can get prescription AZT are generally pretty sick to begin with. We are one of the ATUs that is doing studies on people with T4s between 200 and 800, which is a milder cataloging for ARC, and also for HIV-positive people who now that we did take 500, I think, across the nation under 500, but now that that's closed and we're only taking people 500, T4s to 500 and above. And some of those folks are on full strength, and we also have some off-protocol people who are on full strength 200 every 4 hours. We also did a study, preliminary study for hemophiliacs, in which they were receiving 300 milligrams every 4 hours times five a day. And remarkably, I can't really talk about that, but those folks had very few side effects, and some wonderful things will be coming out of that. The other thing about AZT therapy is, whether it's placebo-controlled or not, or go through a snail's pace, that these people are coming in, and they're coming in regularly and routinely, and we're checking T4s, and we're doing very early diagnosis. We're also, for opportunistic infections, and we're also working up the anemias, which might be HIV-affected, and neutropenia, and some other kinds of things. We're also doing some prophylaxis with aerosolized pentamidine, and we're even trying to do some things in terms of boosting the bone marrow. So I think when I said it's many, many things, if you really stick to and get someone who can work with you, that it can really make a difference. Thank you very much. Okay.
Michael, my name is Dan.
Hi,
I appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
You're really sort of an inspiration to a lot of us. I just wanted to reiterate something that you said earlier and sort of went over so fast, but it's sort of been something that everybody's said in one way or another. I think one thing that's more important than anything else in being a long-term survivor is the will to live and making that conscious decision. There's so many people, I've seen a lot of people that I think once they're diagnosed, they give up. And those are the people that you see die 3 weeks after they're diagnosed. And that's, you know, that's scary, but I think it's a fact. You termed it as the biological will to live. And I think that's really what it's all about. And I think a part of that is also all of these all of these other types of treatments that everybody is doing on their own. It's not so much necessarily what the treatment is, as long as you believe that it's doing something good for you. But that is part of that inherent will to live.
I would agree. That was sort of my suspicion.
Hi, my name is Ron, and I am on full dose of AZT. And you've just heard from my nurse. I was diagnosed last June. The side effects I've had from AZT is gaining 20 pounds, which I didn't need to gain. I felt wonderful. Since that time. Last spring, it was a very filled with turmoil and some deaths in my family. There have been 3 deaths in my family, my mother, grandmother, and an uncle, and a friend who died with AIDS. 2 weeks after my mother died, I was diagnosed as having AIDS. I had no idea that I had it. And about a week after that, driving back from trying to take care of some stuff at my mother's house and selling the house, I started to cry, and what I realized was here was a golden opportunity for transformation and change in my life. And I saw it as something I could take or reject. And I took it as the opportunity to make a change and do something which I felt was important with my life. Up to this time, I've been a college professor. I'm on leave, traveling around the country, and I'm calling this in an RV, which we have, my lover and I have named a recovery vehicle, and on the road to recovery. And my plans are going back and working with people with AIDS who need to hear from people who are doing fine. And that's how I feel about it. And if I've had a total of 3 hours depression since I found out, I think that would be maximum. I can't explain why I have this attitude, except maybe to say that for 8 years I've worked with Gene Houston and Kay Luce, who some of you may know, and read Bernie Siegel's book, and in fact introduced Carol to Bernie Siegel's book, I think, to his tapes. And it's those sorts of things that I think are very important for people to hear. And I must say that I've had only support from people. One of the first things the doctor said to me when I saw him was, "What can I do for you?" And I said, "Tell me the good stories." And his immediate response was, "Yes, that's a big problem. There are lots of good stories, only you never get to hear them." And Carol and the doctor have been very interested in exploring the types of things that are being explored here. And Carol made the effort to come out on her own, not sponsored by the university, but put out her own money and come here saying, "This is important for me to take back to my patients." So, thanks.
Before your question, there are things we can do, and I would like some action to come out of this particular session. Two ideas that occur to me is, it's sort of tradition, I don't know if any of you know, but the People with AIDS Self-Empowerment Movement was founded in Denver in 1983, and it's been very moving for me. I sort of feel this is full circle. And the Denver Principles, they're called the Denver Principles of People with AIDS Self-Empowerment, and they're in the back of this book. Maybe those of us with AIDS and ARC would like to ask the organizers of the conference if we could have 5 or 10 minutes before the closing to stand before everybody, maybe hold hands, say whatever we wanted into a microphone. And I have written a song with a lesbian friend of mine called The Healing Power of Love, which has been adopted as the unofficial theme song of the National Association of People with AIDS. So maybe it wouldn't even have to involve us talking, but we could play The Healing Power of Love and just sort of, again, ground us in why we're all here. So if there are any people with AIDS in ARC who are interested in something like that, see me after this, and maybe we'll approach the conference organizers and try to get 5 or 10 minutes to do that. Now, I'm sorry, your question.
Thank you. My name is Leanna Standish. I'm a research scientist located in Seattle, and I'm standing up here mostly to make a plea for information from the people in this room. It is my opinion that perhaps the most pressing medical problem, a medical question that there is whether or not it is actually true that a coordinated, holistic, natural health program is actually efficacious for AIDS and ARC. And my mission in life right now is putting together an excellent medical team in Seattle to administer that kind of holistic, natural therapeutics for AIDS and ARC patients in Seattle. And that involves homeopathy and acupuncture and nutrition and emotional work, virtually every aspect of natural medicine that seems to have some hope. What I'm asking is for information about how to fund such a project. I have had some dealings with the National Institutes of Health. It looks as though for at least the next few years, the NIH is not going to take responsibility for natural medical research, and I feel like we need to come up with the funding for this kind of research ourselves. And if any of you here have any idea how we could fund such a project, please just look at me and come up and tell me what I could do to get that kind of funding. Thank you.
I would hope that the study would be that you would make some effort to make it a scientifically valid study.
Absolutely, Michael.
And we should talk about the community research initiative concept and exporting it, too, because some of our trials are being paid for not by drug companies but by money raised within the community.
Right. I think it's very important to stress that any kind of clinical trial like this needs to be done with very rigorous scientific methodology. And, in fact, in the future, in the next few years, what I'd really like to see happen is for the AIDS treatment evaluation units to cooperate with people like myself who are working in the natural medical community who have left mainstream science to do this kind of work and to coordinate our efforts in a more efficacious fashion.
Thanks. I don't know how are we doing in terms of time and people's interest and their need for food, and are we at the end of our... Yes, I have the tape with me. Actually, I think it's sitting there on top of... it's right, no, to your left. It says Michael Cowan. I think it's queued up. It says the healing power of love. The most important thing I think that we can do is to be as educated as we can and not to be intimidated. I don't want to set up an adversarial relationship with Western medical establishments. Many, many of these people care and are committed and are burnt out and are wonderful. But the bottom line is it's your life and your body. And when I say be a frisky patient, I don't mean be an obnoxious, you know, pain in the butt just for the sake of being a pain in the butt. But if you feel strongly about something and passionately about something, it's your life and your body, and no one can compel you to take any substance or have any procedure against your will. And so I felt actually throughout this conference, particularly in terms of my exchange with the wonderful Dr. Wolfsey, that she was sort of set up as the doctor. She was the doctor on the panel, and that many of us in the audience vented our frustration at Western medicine on her. And I spoke to her privately afterwards. I know she's doing wonderful work and is wonderful, as are many, many other Western physicians. So I hope that we can work more towards a partnership. But push come to shove, take care of yourself first and do what your instincts tell you. It's your life. Are we in a position to... why don't we practice? People with AIDS and ARC sort of come up front here, and we'll hold hands and maybe hold hands with everybody and form a circle or something. But I'd like people with AIDS and ARC who would like to publicly self-identify join me up here.